Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokesman.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time Skywatcher.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, that show that detests violence in all its forms. I've even been known to trap spiders, which I am irrationally afraid of, and place them carefully outdoors, where, of course, I hope they get eaten by the first bird that flies by. Whatever. Violence and its effects are on our docket today as we contemplate two movies that explore the lives of two men whose very being is affected by their pursuit of a way of being that, at certain points in their lives, they feel drawn toward, only to later be forced to reckon with its lingering darker side. Our first film is The Smashing Machine, a look at the former mixed martial arts fighter Mark Kerr as portrayed by the World Wrestling Federation champion turned actor Dwayne The Rock Johnson. The second is Anemone, directed by Ronan Day-Lewis and starring his father, the esteemed actor Daniel Day-Lewis, as a man struggling to deal with his past experiences as a soldier in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. Let's begin with a trek to the place where over-muscled he-men make money by pounding the spit out of each other. That place, depending on the type of fighting they do, is either a ring or has become just as popular in recent years, the Octagon, which is home to the various MMA events around the globe. Over the years 1997 to 2000, one of the most successful martial artists of the era was a guy named Mark Kerr. In the Benny Safdie written and directed biopic The Smashing Machine, Kerr, played by Dwayne Johnson, is featured during the apex and then downfall of his career. Kerr's story was told before in an HBO documentary of the same title, and it isn't a pretty tale. While Kerr comes across as a decent guy, the fight scenes are necessarily brutal and bloody. Brutal, too, are the fights between Kerr and his then-girlfriend, later wife, for a while, Dawn Staples, played by Emily Blunt. Their codependent relationship portrayed as two high-strung individuals with different, often competing views of what they want out of life. Kerr's friendship with his BFF Mark Coleman, played by the real-life MMA champion Ryan Bader, by contrast, is his one solid source of solace, especially when his life and career go south. Johnson, while still not quite ready to play Shakespeare, acquits himself well, both in the ring and during Kerr's emotional tirades. Blunt and Bader are fine as well, but any award should probably go to the makeup artists who somehow have made Johnson look almost unrecognizable.
I'm going to refer to another commentary on this film by Elisa Wilkinson from the New York Times. And she starts out her review by talking about why do movies get made? And she claims that movies get made for various reasons, but one of them is to provide a showcase for a particular actor. And I really do think in The Smashing Machine, that's perhaps the reason why it's made. I'll be really interested to hear Nathan's take because the director, Benny Safdie, is one of his faves, or at least some of his products, such as Uncut Gems, are one of Nathan's faves. But this movie is based, at least in part, on a 2002 documentary. So The Smashing Machine, as a narrative film, is really sort of following the trajectory of, you know, it's a biopic in a sense, but it's really following the trajectory of this earlier doc. And, you know, I think docs are almost always superior to fictional films. And here, Dan pointed out that this film is extremely brutal and violent, which you could imagine because it's about wrestling, professional wrestling.
It's mixed martial arts, please.
Okay, MMA, sorry, yes. UFC, MMA, I don't know, too many acronyms at any rate. We're really, I think the point of this is to focus on Dwayne Johnson's performance because as we can see from some of the trailers, you can't even recognize him in this particular film. And he does bear an uncanny, although not identical, resemblance to the real Mark Kerr. And so that part's covered here. But I also really liked Dwayne Johnson's performance. He was very low key. And I think that is reflective of who the real Mark Kerr is. But it just didn't have enough of a story, sort of like fighting in Japan, fighting in the U.S., fighting at home, back to, you know, I love me a cheesy sports movie, and this isn't that. I love a good biopic, and this isn't that. So some things to recommend this, especially the performances by the MMA fighters themselves, who are not professionals. But overall, not sure why I went and sat through this for 2 hours. Don't know.
Because I asked you to.
Oh, right. Okay, there was
and
that.
We had a show to do, I guess. Yeah, I'm pretty much right down the line agreeing with you here, because I think the big problem with The Smashing Machine is Benny Safdie's script. I mean, I agree. I don't think he really has a story to tell here, because it feels very repetitious but also kind of underdeveloped at the same point. And I did keep wondering, like, what exactly did he intend with this movie? Why did he want to tell this story? And then the movie ends, as you mentioned, with the real Mark Kerr, and we get some biopic text on the screen telling us what's happened to him in the intervening years. And this happens a lot with these kinds of movies, where I thought the on-screen text doesn't jive with what I assumed was the purpose of the 2 hours that had preceded it. And I also thought that last scene is really effective and moving in a way that nothing before it really was for me. I also think a big problem with The Smashing Machine, and I do agree with you that Dwayne Johnson is really good in this movie, and he would be the reason to see it. I thought the Emily Blunt character was Ooh. So sketchily written. I mean, most of the scenes between her and Johnson involve them screaming at one another, but we really don't understand why. I mean, it's like there's information
missing. How did they get together in the first place?
We don't understand where that animosity is coming from, other than obviously there are substances involved. But the movie is really coy about all of that, and so we don't really understand why they loved each other in the first place or what's going on here. And so I thought that I might have been more sympathetic to what the movie was showing us, and I think the Johnson performance maybe could have swayed me in that direction. But I think it's the weakness of the of that character, of the Emily Blunt character, that I think brings this movie down. I agree with you. I just wondered at the end of it, what exactly was this about, other than being a showcase for the star?
Well, you mentioned that there is this recurring theme of addiction sort of throughout the movie, and Mark Kerr's own addiction, interestingly enough, to opioids. Nothing's mentioned at all about steroids, but you would have to assume that some of these MMA guys were involved in juicing, you know, in some form. And then the Emily Blunt's character, you know, seems to have some alcohol issues. Or is she just a heavy social drinker? But because now he's gotten sober, it creates more of a conflict in their relationship.
The one thing I want to say about Emily Blunt is I'm going to stand up for this. In recent years, she has turned in several performances in which she's a likable, lovable character. But this is more reminiscent of the role, I think, that really brought her first attention, which was in The Devil Wears Prada, mm-hmm. in which she was just a horrible person. And this,
But enjoyably horrible.
Enjoyably yeah, horrible. Yeah. That, I think that's a matter of opinion. But but what I will say is that regardless of the weakness of the character as written by Safdie, and maybe it was based, I've never seen the documentary, so maybe it's based directly on the documentary, but it is not a very good view of women.
Yeah, I don't think so. And it's not the issue with the performance. I think she acquits herself well. I just don't think there's really anything there.
And we also didn't talk about Ryan Bader, who plays Mark Coleman. This guy is a non-actor, which is another thing that I think Safdie loves to do.
Yes, and that's what I like about the Safdie's movies, is that they like to put non-actors or first-time performers alongside big movie stars.
They put uncut gems in their films.
I mean, yeah, there you go. I like that. And this also has that Safdie visual style we expect, that was shot on 16mm, and so
yeah,
it's grainy
and
handheld.
Yeah, it's a very documentary style.
I also saw an interview with him where he talked about the camera in the fight scenes is always outside the ring. The ropes are always between us and the fighters.
True.
So as if he was trying to create that the idea of like being in the audience to watch it. I thought that was a pretty, you know, a relatively effective visual strategy.
Well, and it also shows us how this whole sport has developed, because at one point they're competing for this $200,000 prize, and I actually guffawed. I was like, $200,000? Yeah. Oh.
While you're getting knees to the head.
Another thing about, and probably the last point we want to make about The Smashing Machine is it shows the magic of the movies, because if you've seen photographs of Mark Kerr, he was a muscled guy, but Dwayne Johnson is huge, and he comes across huge on screen.
He's like a wall.
Kerr was not that big.
This movie.
Yeah. At any rate, That was our discussion of The Smashing Machine. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to talk about Anemone. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
Peter Sagal here from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. If you're a member of this NPR station, thank you. It means a lot. Now, if you were looking for another way to help the station, you could, I don't know, call up all your friends and ask them to donate on your behalf repeatedly at all hours of the day and night until they just give in to get rid of you or block your number. Or you could just donate a vehicle you no longer need. It's up to you. Annoy your friends or free up space in your garage. Your choice.
Visit SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thank you.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the Dwayne The Rock Johnson vehicle, The Smashing Machine. Let's now turn to something far more magically realistic, if no less trying on the emotions. A film that uses the twin references to a lovely flower and a venomous sea invertebrate to explore the emotions of a man beleaguered by the effects of his wartime service. As a flower, the colorful anemone is said to be an easy way to create a blanket of vibrancy in your yard. As a sea creature, the anemone carries a sting that can stun its prey with paralyzing efficiency. Both those disparate characteristics describe Ray, played by Daniel Day-Lewis, a former British soldier now living in as secluded a four spot as one is apt to find in the United Kingdom. Visited by his brother Jem, played by Sean Bean, Ray gives away little of himself as the two joust, drinking, taking long walks on the beach, and even wrestling to the point of drawing blood. But finally, he breaks down, and the various parts of the film directed by Ronan Day-Lewis, Daniel Day-Lewis's son, and co-written by father and son, come together. They involve not just a harsh family history, but Ray's strained relationship with his ex-wife, played by Samantha Morton, and his troubled son, played by Samuel Bottomley, as well as Ray's own experiences as a special operative in Northern Ireland during the Troubles, one incident in particular that still haunts him. The young Day-Lewis tends to get a bit too artsy with his visuals, as if he wants to complicate a somewhat standard story with a wavering sense of haunting imagery. But the elder Day-Lewis, whose last appearance on screen came in 2017's Phantom Thread, and a man who once quit acting so that he could learn how to make shoes in Florence, Italy, still manages to prove that he's one of the great screen actors ever to deliver a line.
Yeah, I don't think it's a hot take to say that Daniel Day-Lewis is a spectacular actor, and he can make just about anything watchable to an extent. I don't think that his performance in Anemone is one of his best. I mean, I think he's obviously good, but I don't know if this movie would have gotten made if he had not been involved in it, because it feels to me like a short story or a novella that has been stretched almost to its breaking point.
It would have made a nice 20-minute short film.
Yeah,
I
mean, but this is 2 hours and 5 minutes, and boy, I felt pretty much every one of those minutes. And let's be honest here, I don't think that Daniel Day-Lewis inhabits a real character here. He inhabits a series of monologues. It's pages and pages of dialogue, and they're beautifully delivered, but they feel like an actor's exercise to me. And Sean Bean, who is his scene partner in most of these scenes, is fine, but he's mostly just listening to Daniel Day-Lewis.
He's
sitting there kind of slack-jawed while Daniel Day-Lewis runs circles around him at one point, quite literally. And I also love Samantha Morton. I think she is one of the most underrated actors of her generation. And here it is again. It's the one female character in the movie, the major female character. And she's just a total afterthought here. I mean, she's supposed to represent like the green light across the water that continues to haunt the Day-Lewis character. And she just doesn't become a fleshed out human being here because she's just not given the screen time. So I don't know. I mean, it is an impeccably professionally made movie. It's, again, very well acted. But my hands kind of closed on air at the end of this. It just really didn't work for me at all.
Apparently, I liked this better than you did because you didn't really like it very much at all.
No.
And so what did I like about this movie, Anemone? To say that you enjoy this movie might be a little strong. But I was, unlike you, engaged throughout. I was just waiting to see what was going to happen next in terms of the story. I mean, it's a gradual reveal about what happened. And I think these whole sort of moral complexities of war, I mean, recently Dan and I listened to this podcast, The Line. There was just that recent article in the New York Times Magazine about Green Berets. And so I appreciated the attempt to kind of capture that from and how this has affected our main character, Ray, for such a lengthy period of time, because he felt as though what happened back in the day that, you know, he had done the right thing. And apparently others strongly disagreed with that. And I thought it was beautifully filmed. I mean, some of these images are kind of burned in my brain. I know Dan and I talked about Anemone afterwards, and there's one sequence where they're sort of going through this carnival. And Dan, you can speak to that a little bit more. But I like that scene. I like these scenes of the ocean and the sunset. And it just, I thought the way it was filmed provided a contrast to the underlying, you know, scheme or theme that was happening here. The one thing that pulled me out of it a little bit was physically, you couldn't imagine two people who are more different than Sean Bean and Daniel Day-Lewis. So buying them as brothers, I think, was a difficult, you know, that I had to suspend some disbelief there. But yeah, I like this film a lot more than you did.
Yeah, and I'm stuck in between the two of you because I think there are real problems with Anemone. I think that about halfway through, I began thinking, you know, this is more of a stage play than a movie. It is long blocks of...
But how are you going to do the carnival?
Well, yeah, that's a good... I was going to get to that, if you'll just let me get to it. The thing I really liked about it, once I began thinking of it as a stage play, it began to work better for me. But what I really liked about it were the visuals, and especially the visuals done by, obviously, drones over this forest where, you know, there's this one little opening where his cabin is, which is basically, you know, where a survivalist would live. But the scene that you were talking about, they come walking off the beach and they walk past this carnival, which is brightly lit. And I go, this serves absolutely no function at all in this movie except to show, oh, we have more colors.
Beautiful. That's not and that's, why it was there.
And
I'm
that's
sorry.
When I, that's
no,
when I went, this movie may have just jumped the shark. But it brought me back into it after that. But
I don't think that's what was going on at all. I think that he was living in this isolated setting, but he was really so close to, like, the action, this village.
To civilization. You know,
what was, yeah, so that was fascinating, that contrast. You think, oh... And that's why I appreciated it. It sort of underscored that, you know, he's not of the world, but the world's right there ready to receive him if he's ready to go back.
It's funny because you're arguing over the thematic importance of the carnival, and I'm just sitting here thinking, there's also a carnival scene in The Smashing Machine, the first movie we talked about. So that I've been zoning out thinking about that, connecting the dots between these very different movies.
You know, I want to take issue with you about your thoughts about his acting.
Yeah.
I think that there are at least two scenes in which he breaks down, and it is amazing acting.
Oh, yeah.
It is some of the best acting he's ever done. And,
I'm not saying he's bad in this. I just don't think the material is up to him. He enlivens it for sure. Also, when I'm saying this isn't one of his best performances, we're talking about one of the two or three greatest actors that's alive. Like, you know, so the bar is very high. I agree with you about the visuals, and it's why I think this had to be a movie and not a play, because I think the visuals are the strongest component.
A visual artist.
And the movie was shot by Ben Fordsman, who also shot the Rose Glass movies, Saint Maud and Love Lies Bleeding. And he has this really nice style where, you know, it's always kind of threatening to veer off into strange, nightmarish territory. And the locations, as you mentioned, are just breathtaking. There's one scene I really liked in Anemone, and it's I won't spoil too much, but it involves an unlikely weather event that happens near the end and kind of connects all the characters in a way that I wanted more of. There's all of this talk about acts of God throughout the movie, and this is where that really seemed to kind of, you know, explode to life. And it reminded me of the storm at the end of the Coen Brothers' A Serious Man or the rain of frogs in Magnolia, where it has this sort of uncanny feeling to it. But it felt real at the same time. And I thought that scene struck a nice balance between the tones that he's clearly going for here and the rest of the movie. Just it didn't give me that same kind of feeling.
We also get a backstory that turns into this harsh scatological monologue that I think has gotten some notoriety. But I thought maybe they went a little bit too far. You know, this is different than Mr. Hanky Poo. But it, as a practical matter, it told us more about our character. It really did give us insight into what he sort of battled in his home life, at school, in the army, et cetera.
And whether or not we can trust a lot of the things that he says.
Yeah, we don't know.
That's right. And also, you wonder his breakdown. Is it because he lost his position in the army, or is he really questioning whether he did the right thing that got him kicked out of the army? One final point I wanted to make about stage play in this. You say this had to be a movie. I don't agree, because if you've been to the theater lately, you can see what they can do in terms of all sorts of CGI in a theater itself.
I guess that might
be more of effective.
I guess I'd rather pay $12 for a movie ticket than, you know, $312 for a Broadway ticket.
Go to London, pal, and it's only £100.
Well, you know how much it costs to get to London. I think I'll be spending a little more than £100.
Yeah, well, at any rate, that was our discussion of the Ronan Day-Lewis film Anemone. And this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Murray Pat Truthart, and I discussed Benny Safdie's The Smashing Machine. Let's take this moment to thank Cassie Fox for both technical directing and editing the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer wherever we can find it. Until then, consider these words from the late economist E.F. Schumacher. Any intelligent fool can make things bigger, more complex, and more violent. It takes a touch of genius and a lot of courage to move in the opposite direction. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.